Hi, I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Rebecca Davis, and this is Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR Science Desk.
On this week's show, we'll get an update from Japan. Some water, milk, and vegetables have tested positive for radiation.
And we'll catch up with our blogger Scott Hensley on all the other stuff you may have missed this week, like car seat safety and the link between heart attacks and sex.
And we'll follow local greens from farm to market to one chef's kitchen.
But first, it is hard to believe that it's been a whole year since President Obama signed the health care bill into law.
Today, after almost a century of trying, today, after over a year of debate, today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
But turning the bill into law did not settle the debate. As NPR's Julie Robner reports, it merely changed the terms.
In case you've forgotten, the health law was intended to dramatically change the direction of the health care system. It will require nearly every American to have health insurance by the year 2014, but it will also provide substantial help for those who can't otherwise afford it. As the law's first anniversary approached, supporters like House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi scheduled events to sing its praises.
With this landmark law, we made health insurance and health care a right, not a privilege, by extending coverage to 32 million more Americans.
Meanwhile, opponents like Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch here on the PBS NewsHour have been considerably more downbeat.
I hate to talk this way, but it's true. It is one of the worst pieces of legislation in the history of this country.
In fact, sowing seeds of doubt about the law is all part of opponents' strategy, says Michael Cannon, head of health policy for the Libertarian Cato Institute. That's because at the moment, with Democrats still in control of the Senate and presidency, opponents know they can't actually do much to change the law.
So if you want a legislative fix to Obamacare, if you want to repeal it, you have to keep it unpopular between now and January of 2013.
That's the soonest Republicans could gain enough control to make the law go away. So what needs to happen between now and then?
You try to keep the law from taking root, and you try to educate the public about all its harmful effects.
That's why all the defunding and repeal votes in Congress, not to mention the dozens of lawsuits challenging the law's constitutionality. Of course, if you're supporting the law, what you want is to sink those roots in so deep as to make the law, well, unrepealable. Cannon knows a little something about that, too.
You want to create constituencies that will fight to preserve it. And by sending $250 checks to seniors, you may be creating constituencies. By giving tax credits and subsidies to employers, you may be creating constituencies. And certainly, when the law begins spending hundreds of billions of dollars on health insurance subsidies to low and middle income Americans, you're going to be creating a huge constituency.
And those are just a few of the law's benefits, things like starting to fill in the Medicare prescription drug donut hole for seniors. Ron Pollack of Families USA, who does support the law, says that as the public sees more of the law's benefits, support for it will grow. But he says it's about more than just buying off individual constituencies. It's about what the law actually does for people.
Those people who've got pre-existing conditions, they don't want to be denied coverage by insurance companies. Those people who've got health conditions, they don't want to be charged an arm and a leg in discriminatory premiums. When people get sick, they don't want to lose the health coverage they've been paying for many years.
Pollack also says supporters of the law are still fighting to help the public understand the 2,000-page-plus measure.
There are so many myths about this legislation, from death panels, government takeover, that this is adding to the deficit. None of those things are true.
Health law opponent Cannon, meanwhile, is worried that many Republican governors who oppose the law are undercutting their arguments by working with the Obama administration to set up the new insurance marketplaces known as health exchanges.
Governors should not be taking the funds that are available under this law and not setting up those new government bureaucracies, because that further entrenches the law.
In other words, on the law's first birthday, it's still one big race, a competition between supporters who hope the health law will have many more birthdays to celebrate and opponents who'd like to blow out the candles permanently. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
And now we welcome our enterprising health blogger, Scott Hensley. Hi, Scott.
Hi, April. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Scott.
Hey.
So, Scott, this week you posted a study that connects the frequency of sex with the risk of heart attacks. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, indeed. Our diligent colleague, Nancy Shoot, investigated the matter, and here's the conclusion. There is a small risk, increased risk of heart attack for people who don't have sex or exercise much and then start doing it.
But just a little, right?
Yes, that's right. Absolute risk is small, but these researchers did find a little increase. So the bottom line?
Do it more.
Do it more, or don't do it at all.
Well, what do we mean by frequency and infrequency? We need some helpful guidelines here, basically.
Let's call Nancy Shute. She wrote the post.
Okay, let's see if I can get her on the line. She's at her desk. I know she's really busy, so hold on 1 second, and I'll get her on the line.
Hello?
Hi, Nancy.
Oh, hi, Rebecca.
Hi, we're recording the podcast right now. I'm here with April and Scott.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hey there.
We had a question about one of your posts. It was the one relating, there was the relationship between the frequency of sex and exercise with a risk of heart attacks. And we didn't know what frequent and infrequent meant.
Well, you know, that's a really good question because these folks were epidemiologists, the researchers. They were looking at studies that had already been done. And so when I asked them things like, you know, what kind of exercise, you know, how often, they really weren't sure because they were looking at a lot of different studies. But they did say that the risk went up with 1 hour of extra physical or sexual activity a week. So, and it looks like they were really dealing with couch potatoes in these studies. You know, they were looking at people who weren't very active.
Asexual couch potatoes.
Yes. Couch potatoes who got no action.
Okay.
But they were really nervous about putting this study out there because they were worried that people would think that if you exercise, you're going to drop dead, or if you have sex. And they really didn't want to make sure that people don't get that as the take-home message. What's important is that that's a really tiny transient effect, and in the course of your, you know, spread out over your life, it really doesn't make much difference at all. But what really makes a difference is exercising, and for each hour of exercise you add in to your life weekly, your relative risk for having that nasty heart attack falls by 30%.
And is sex interchangeable with exercise?
Apparently so.
Okay.
Looks like it.
All right.
Good news. I'm dropping my gym membership.
Nancy, you get all the good stories. We're very jealous.
Thanks.
Oh, thanks. Great talking to
okay.
you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
So, Scott, you also had a post about some new advice for car safety seats in infants.
Yes, and this is something that I've gone through recently in my own household, and I think we talked about it a little bit in the newsroom.
Yeah.
As a parent, you can't wait to get your kid out of the car seat or to turn the car seat around so that they're facing forward. And the leading group of pediatricians in the United States said, not so fast.
Don't rush it.
Don't rush it. And they said two things. They said, wait until the child turns two before you get them facing toward the windshield, keep them looking backward, or they reach a certain height and weight, which is in the post. The message here is just because they've reached that first birthday, which is the number that most people have in mind when they're thinking about the orientation of the car seat, don't do it just on the birthday number. You should wait until they're the right size.
And similarly, there was also another part of this recommendation that talked about older kids, too, and getting them out of the booster seat. What was that?
Well, and indeed, you should keep your kid in a booster seat until at least 8 was what the rule was, and maybe as until they're 12. And again, you have to do it based on their size, their weight, and their height.
Right, right. And that does make sense if you look at a child that's a little too small for it. You can see where the seatbelt is hitting them in kind of an unsafe place.
That's exactly right, because that's the idea of the booster seat, is that you're putting them in the position where the seatbelt can keep them safe.
I think it's going to be a challenge to keep an older kid in a booster seat like that.
They're pretty anxious to get out. Yeah,
they are.
That's right. Scott, there's also something else I know you really wanted to talk about this week in the podcast. You recently had the opportunity to interview Andrew Witty, and he's the CEO of GlaxoSmithKline.
That's right. He was kind enough to drop by, and we sat down in a recording studio, and he told me about some of the things the company is trying to do in the developing world to help people in some of the poorest people around the globe get the kinds of care and medicines that they need. And he also talked pretty honestly and straightforwardly about the challenges that his company faces as part of the pharmaceutical industry in rebuilding trust with the public. Andrew, thanks for coming today. I know that you've got something to say about some changes that you're making to the company to open up the labs a little bit more and also to meet some of the demands of the developing world.
No, I'm happy to do that. And at GSK over the last couple of years, we've been really focused on trying to push the boundaries of what we can do to try and make a difference here. We spent 2 years essentially looking at every molecule that GSK has in its library. We have about 2 million different molecules. These are essentially, the best way to think about this, are starting materials for future drugs. So we have 2 million different starting points, and we screened them all against the malaria parasite, and we found 13,000 of those 2 million, which may one day be a starting material which could turn into a drug against malaria. We've published all of those chemical structures of all of those 13,000 onto the web and basically invited any researcher anywhere in the world, if they want to use that information to help their own research, they're more than welcome to do it.
By doing that, do you close the door on developing something that would be of commercial value?
Essentially, what we've decided to do is that for the least developed countries in the world, the poorest 50 or 60 countries in the world, and for the neglected tropical diseases, so these kind of very Africa-specific diseases, what we're essentially saying is that we're going to do everything we can to try and leverage our resources to make it easy for somebody to discover a treatment, and we're not going to apply very significant burden on that. What we do say, however, is if one of those molecules turns out to be a useful medicine in the West, then of course GSK reserves the right to develop that for application in the West. Because again, if we can use our technologies to help speed up their success, all to the good.
You talked last year to the Council of Foreign Relations about how you wanted to change the company to make it more open, change the way the company's perceived and also the way that it does business.
More broadly, I believe that the pharmaceutical industry as a total industry, and of course GSK as a major company within it, needs to be much more modern in its outlook, needs to be much more open and transparent in the way it engages with society, and needs to focus on making sure that we're delivering value for money to society, that we're delivering medicines that make a difference, and we're doing all of that in a way which people trust us for. And it's clear that over the last 10 or 20 years, that level of trust has been eroded for all sorts of reasons. We need to work hard to re-earn that trust, and that's about the substance of what we do, making sure we focus our research dollars on finding treatments and vaccines for serious diseases, not simply a tweak on a previously already treated disease. We need to make sure that we are publishing all of our information in a very transparent way so that people can judge the quality of our science. We should be open to independent criticism, and we should be focused on making sure that we are trying to meet not just the needs of people in the West, but people across the whole world.
A few months back, Deirdre Connolly, the president of your U.S. operations, gave quite a speech here in Washington, which I wrote about for Shots, on how the company was looking to change the way that it sold and marketed medicines here in the United States. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about how you see that?
Well, the big picture, I think, really comes down to the two really crucial underpinnings of what we need to ensure. One is that we are building, not losing, trust in the industry and the company. And two is that we are doing everything we possibly can to make sure that the contribution of the medicines and vaccines that we develop creates value, clinical value for the patient.
Recently, the pharmaceutical industry in total surpassed the defense industry in the volume and value of fraud that had been perpetrated against the federal government. And I think that steady drip of settlements and different judgments against the companies has been part of what has corroded people's trust.
Whether it's controversy over whether data is published on time, whether or not it's controversy about independence of data being published, whether it's settlements of cases with federal authorities, all of these things are simply flashpoints of a general trend. The reality is the industry has to change the way it operates. It has to ensure that it is meeting an ever-increasing standard of scrutiny and expectation.
Andrew, thank you very much for coming by and talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You can read more about the interview on the blog, Shots, at npr.org.
Well, thanks, Scott. Of course, the main news we've been following this week is what's happening to the people of Japan in the wake of the earthquake, tsunami, and major problems at the country's nuclear power plants. Scott, you just put up a post from Richard Knox about everyday people trying to map out radiation levels across the country.
I thought this was interesting. It's a very democratizing effort at trying to get radiation information.
Right. A web developer in Portland, Oregon came up with this idea. It's something that the company he works for does. And the notion was, why not get citizen scientists out in the world armed with Geiger counters to make measurements and then put them on a map combined with some of the data that are coming from the authorities in Japan so that people could see pretty much in real time how things are going.
It sounds kind of like when on the morning traffic they ask people, if you're caught in a traffic jam or you see an accident, call this number.
Exactly. Crowdsourcing.
But there's a problem with this, I think, right?
Well, I think there's some caveats, and Dick wanted to check it out, and he talked to a couple of radiation experts who said that measuring radiation, even with a Geiger counter, which you can buy online, though they're in short supply lately, is technically a little bit challenging. You've got to calibrate the instrument properly, and you have to make sure that you keep it clean. If, for instance, radioactive material contaminates the Geiger counter, then you're going to get some very high readings wherever you go. So they said they liked the idea, but they offered some caution about making too much out of the numbers from people who were not experienced necessarily doing this.
Is this map actually up, though, with people's readings on the map?
Yes, it is. If people go to Shots, we have a link. We have a picture of the of the map as it existed this week, and people can click on that, and they can see the latest readings there.
Okay. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Now another story from Japan. Government officials are asking people not to eat spinach, parsley, and other produce grown near the damaged plant because some is tainted with radiation. Dairy farmers are dumping milk, and drinking water has been a problem in some locations, too. NPR's Richard Harris reports that the biggest impact is in the region where these foods are produced.
You might expect that reports of radiation on food would create a sense of panic in Japan. But step into the Echo's grocery store in Ibaraki Prefecture, and nothing seems to be amiss.
Hey, put them all.
Produce manager Kenki Utsuno is restocking the shelves with a leafy green called kumatsuna. Even though this region has been hit with traces of radiation, the shelves here are full of cabbage, radishes, many different types of mushrooms, even spinach. But it's not from around here.
Usually we like to have local fruits and vegetables, but since the problem in Fukushima, even for vegetables other than just spinach, we're trying to import from outside of the prefecture just to help the customers feel safe.
It's typical in Japan that each piece of produce is labeled with the place it was grown, so people can buy spinach that they know was harvested far from the nuclear reactors. But Utsuno says people are buying less of all produce as they react to what they're hearing on the news. An older woman named Yoko Kiaiko is trying to decide between two different varieties of cabbage, and she doesn't care where they were grown.
I try not to think about it, I don't worry about it, and I just choose depending on the price.
The brunt of this crisis is most evident out in the countryside. A few miles from the grocery store, Keiji Nagashima tends a spinach farm that he inherited from his father. He's been growing spinach for 25 years here in Ibaraki. This region is a major source of produce for Tokyo, which is just a couple of hours away by truck.
Is it a good business?
It's hard work.
Nagashima is standing outside a row of six long greenhouses. In January, he planted 30,000 spinach plants in each one. His farm wasn't tested, so he doesn't even know if the plants are contaminated. But the government has said all spinach from Ibaraki Prefecture needs to be destroyed.
I think what we'll end up doing is just let the spinach die, and then after that we'll bury it.
Will you get paid for it?
Yeah, まだ何も聞いてます。
Personally, they haven't told me anything.
Do you grow anything other than spinach?
Yeah, 今はほうれん草だけです。
Right now, just spinach.
So this is your whole livelihood?
できないです。
Yeah, I can't have a life without the spinach.
He's getting advice from Junichi Matsuda. He works for the Japanese Agricultural Extension Service. Matsuda says the government intends to pay the farmers for their lost crops, but at the moment they're tied up dealing with the much bigger crisis up the coast. Matsuda takes a deep drag on his cigarette and says that he's personally a bit worried, but not enough to stop eating the vegetables he grows in his own garden.
I'm living my life as I was before, and I'm continuing to spend time outside, and so I'm not worried. The country has assured us that we're safe, and so I trust them.
In fact, we heard that refrain often. People in Japan respect and trust their government. A loudspeaker that's part of Japan's emergency response network broadcasts the latest news about conditions for farmers out in their fields. The word is that the water here has been tested and it's not contaminated. We head back into town and our interpreter, Emiko Omori, stops into her local grocery store to buy bottled water for her school-aged children.
I can't really find any big bottles of water. This man's buying up small ones that I have, too, so maybe he's looking for the same thing.
It's been this way since the earthquake and tsunami 12 days before, she says. Small bottles will have to do.
No big bottles of water.
Richard Harris, NPR News, Tokyo.
In America, there is still no risk to the public from radiation, not from the air and certainly not from produce. Here, farmers are still busy growing fresh greens. Rebecca, you visited a farm in Virginia with Nancy Shute just a few weeks ago.
That's right, we did, and it was really not yet spring, and yet the farmer there was growing these amazing greens, just a rich variety of greens. He has mastered a somewhat unusual art of growing all different kinds of greens throughout the depths of winter.
It's a cold, wet morning at the DuPont Circle Fresh Farm Market in Washington, D.C., but here are 8, 9, 10 people standing in the rain waiting to buy fresh greens. The farmer's name is Zach Lester.
I have a Scottish curly kale. It's like an old heirloom kale, really deals with the winter. Italian mustard.
Even in the depths of winter, in the ice and snow, Zach was here selling his greens.
Hi, can I get half a pound of the red Russian kale?
Leafy greens like kale are some of the healthiest of vegetables, full of vitamins, minerals, phytonutrients, and fiber. Just picked greens have more of the good stuff because nutrients degrade when greens are shipped from far away. But most of us live in places where nothing grows in the winter, or so we think.
All right, there you go. Thank you.
Zach Lester grows fresh greens outdoors all winter long, just 80 miles south of Washington, where it's freezing cold and often snowy. How can that be? I went to Tree and Leaf Farm in Unionville, Virginia, to find out.
Let's take a walk out there. Let's trot through the mud.
Things aren't looking too springy here. The fields look barren and flat. But as we walk closer, I realize that they're not barren at all. There's row upon row of sturdy, stumpy plants.
And I have parsley and red Russian kale, and I have frisée.
This form of winter farming is unusual in the United States. To do it, you have to know your plants. Those Russian kales can take the cold, but not all greens are that tough. To protect them, Zach has set up arched shelters covered with plastic sheeting.
We have arugula here, so I had to really sow that into the soil right after Christmas. We've had 2 harvests off these beds of arugula. And
there's no heat in these shelters or artificial light, but Zach's wife, Georgia O'Neill, says the winter sun can make it feel like May.
You could be February and 30 degrees outside, and if the sun's out, you're sweating inside here.
When Zach set out to try winter farming, he studied up. It turns out that before the age of jumbo jets flying in salad from who knows where, people had figured out how to grow greens in winter. Zach is inspired by the market farmers of 19th century France.
You know, the turn of the century, Paris had its own food system year-round. They farmed in these small plots outside of the city.
Though this system is simple, it's not easy. Georgia says they struggle against the wind and cold.
farming in the wintertime, it is definitely a labor of love. I mean, I cleared snow with Zach this winter. It was a wet snow, and it was night, and it was hard to see. You take brooms, and you push them up over your head to push the snow off of your high tunnel. It is one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life.
These two farmers met up in, of all places, New York City. Zach had been working in horticulture and this and that. One night, he went to a party and saw an amazing salad.
In the salad, there was one edible calendula flower, and I was like, huh, interesting. Who made the salad? Can I have that edible flower?
Georgia made that salad. She was gardening on her rooftop in Brooklyn. Zach knew just how to win her heart.
Zach romanced me with food. He brought me back up harvest. Ladies, you would die. He blew me away.
She felt the love.
Zach convinced Georgia to move to his home state of Virginia so they could make a business of growing greens through the winter. That business is labor-intensive, planting and harvesting by hand. That hand labor makes for more expensive greens. A pound of Georgia and Zach's salad mix costs $9, compared to about $6 for organic greens at the supermarket.
People are going to have to pay a little bit more for that hard work.
Are you seeing there's a suffering tax there from the farmer?
Sure, that's sure. There's a suffering tax.
That's a tax a lot of people are willing to pay.
This is nice.
Back at the farmer's market, people are scooping up pounds and pounds of greens.
I'm addicted to the baby Swiss chard.
I love all the vegetables.
It's the great taste that's got these people excited. Nora Puyon is in line. She buys Zach's greens for her restaurant, Nora, which is just a few blocks from the market.
Look all this chard. It's beautiful. I think it's called rainbow chard because every leaf has a different color.
Because in early spring, what could be sweeter than a rainbow of chard? Nancy Shute, NPR News.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile. And inch by inch, row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rain comes tumbling down.
So, what would chef and restaurant owner Nora Puyon do with all those greens she ordered from the farmer? NPR's Linda Wertheimer went to find out.
We found Nora Puyon in the kitchen at her restaurant Nora, a tiny workspace built around a huge stove, pots and pans hanging above, and a cutting board stocked with bins of greens and garnishes.
But I think they're good. They taste like radish.
Nora's wearing her white chef's jacket, checking preparations for a private luncheon, but she's promised to take a moment to teach us how to prepare greens at home without hours of cooking or a hammock.
Now, we've all been eating roots and tubers all winter. So this is the opportunity to eat the green things. Now, what are we going to look at here?
It's a mixture of chard, mustard greens, and kale. Actually, this comes from the farmer's market. And one advantage from the farmer's market is that the farmers pick things when they're very small.
Baby greens like these are tender. They can be sautéed quickly. Older, bigger greens from the grocery store take a little more attention.
What you do, you sort of rip out the stem, because the stem is really very tough. So what you can do, you use the leaves, and then what I do is I just slice them thin.
Into what's called a chiffonade, so they'll cook more quickly. For the baby greens, Nora's chef, Todd Woods, puts a sauté pan on the burner and pulls out a container of garlic. Nora says, start with the strongest greens in your mix, and she likes her greens cooked in olive oil.
So I think what he does, he gets the pan hot.
Okay, I'm going to start off with the sliced garlic into the pan. I'm going to toast your garlic just a little bit to release the oil and the flavor.
I can smell the garlic. You're not going to let it brown, is that the deal?
No, you don't want it to brown. It'll take on a bitter flavor if you let it brown. In with the kale first. Toss it with the garlic.
You just stir it down till it gets smaller?
You don't want it to go all the way wilted down because you want to retain as many nutrients in the greens as possible, which they have the most of when they're raw.
You added some
mustard greens.
You've got a good arm for tossing. I don't know if I could quite do that, but salt.
A little salt. I would normally put a little pepper in with just plain kale, but since we're throwing in all these mustard greens and they're very peppery on their own, probably wasn't needing any pepper in here. So,
on top of the mustard green went the
rainbow chard. We'll finish off with a little bit of vermouth.
Why vermouth?
Well, winter greens are very hardy, and they lend themselves to a drier wine for wilting down. You want them to retain a little bit of their crunch. So, there we go.
Okay, I'm just going to take a really impolitely large bite. Very juicy. Very, very good.
All right, bon appetit, and that's all for Your Health, NPR's weekly health podcast. We had production assistance from Adam Cole
and our health blogger, Scott Hensley. You can see all the newest blog posts or browse through our archives at npr.org/shots. We'll be back again next week.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.